This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of The Overcomers, God's Vision for You to Thrive in an Age of Anxiety and Outrage, written and narrated by pastor and best-selling author Matt Chandler, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Greetings and God bless. Welcome to another episode of Pass the Mic, Dynamic Voices for a Diverse Church, powered by The Witness, a Black Christian collective. I am your host, Tyler Burns. You can follow me on Twitter at Burns23, follow at your own risk. And joining me, as always, is the president of The Witness, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Blue Check Verified himself, Jamar Tisby. What's going on, brother?
Hey, man, just appreciate all our Pass the Mic listeners. Every time we get on the mic, it's great to talk to you, but it's also wonderful to think about the folks who are listening and all the positive feedback we get, the ways that God uses this podcast in just unbelievable ways. So just shout out to the PTM fam, man. Really appreciate y'all.
Yes, shout out to the PTM fam. And if you're listening to this podcast, beyond subscribing, beyond liking, beyond sharing, beyond retweeting, beyond sending this podcast to your friends and your family and all the people that you know who would like this, I want to solicit that you pray for us, please. Yes. We are adulting hard, and it is very difficult. And we've been talking, even before we hopped on the mic, we talked for about 30 minutes, 45 minutes about just personal burdens and cares and concerns. And so sometimes I was telling Jamar, we don't let you as listeners into that, because there's a part of that we want to keep private, but then there's another part of that we want to say, pray for us. And if we got all these people listening to the podcast, the effectual fervent prayer, as they say in the King James, of a righteous man avails much. So please use your effectual fervent prayer and pray for Jamar and I. Tons of things going on, book coming out for him in January. We're trying to plan a conference, family expanding, all these crazy things are happening. So we solicit your prayers. And so if you're not able to give, if you're not able to share, if you're not able to do any of those things, if you pray for us, we appreciate that. And great is your reward in heaven. We may not know that you're praying for us, but we believe we'll feel those prayers and that the Lord will bless you for that.
Amen to that.
So I want to get into part two of last time we were recording. We talked about politics. We talked about kind of the racialized way in which our politics have been framed and some of the specific politicians. And since then, it didn't turn out any different than we thought it would, right, Jamar?
Not at all.
I mean, it was just pretty obvious what was going to happen, but we were talking about it and I'm like, man, maybe, you know, that's kind of been my thing with politics. Man, maybe, you know, maybe it might not be the same way it's always been. And then typically it's the same way it's always been, right?
Yeah. But we look at the progress made. So, for instance, last time we were talking, it was the Mississippi Senate runoff. And of course, the Democratic contender lost. But at the same time, he made a stronger showing than any candidate in like the past 30 or 40 years. And so looking at how people mobilized on the ground, the grassroots effort, and how that might build momentum for the next race, you know, not really picking a party or anything, but just looking at the ways that even the party that loses, what happened? What does it tell us about their formation and what might happen in the future?
And is there some sort of growth that we can take from that,
right?
You know, especially when it comes to the racialized narratives that one party or another might embrace and propose, that would be something that we would kind of say, okay, well, if people are growing, able to identify, hey, this is wrong. We may not have been able to oust you in particular, but maybe we can pick a better candidate next time. Maybe we can challenge you in the primary. All those things could be growth potential. So I totally understand. But I also still think the same thing. Sometimes I'm like, man, it's the same thing every time. And these political shows that make it seem like there's intrigue and there's all this. And you're just watching the votes and you're like, I got to stop watching this. So I'm curious, because we were talking today about how we were going to express our own way of thinking about politics, because that's the whole point of this episode. How do we think about the political process, political elections. And so I think it would be helpful for people who don't know and for people who do, for us to kind of give a history of our own political beliefs. So, Jamar, what's the history of your own politics? And I'm not saying you got to go down each issue. I'm just saying the history of how you were introduced to politics, what you formerly believed, and has that changed at all?
It's funny you ask that because...
Yeah, that laugh by Jamar, that laugh, I love No, it is.
It's the irony.
You did that same one on the Donald Trump episode. On the Donald Trump episode, you did that same laugh.
No, it's the irony. As a student of history, I have a horrible memory personally. Like, it's very hard for me to trace my own personal timeline on any topic. I remember being in, I guess, elementary school, and Ross Perot was a independent candidate. And I was like,
yeah,
this dude, he sounds cool, because he was a millionaire. He was out of the mainstream. He just and when he first got in the race, it seemed like he actually had a chance. Then he pulled some old wild stuff, withdrew, and then jumped back in. But that, I think that's the earliest memory I have of being interested in voting. We had a little mock election at our school, all that good stuff. But then,
bro, I got to talk about these mock elections, man.
Did you have
so one? You had? Listen, I did. So I remember I was in third grade. And it was, I think it was Clinton Dole. So it was Clinton versus Bob Dole. And then I think Ross Perot was running that one again, too. And I just remember we voted. And then I stepped outside. It was on election day. We voted. And it's funny because how do third graders know how to vote? Like, what does that even mean for us? Like, we're thinking, does the girl next to me like me? Like, that's what we're thinking about. We're thinking
today?
About it. Yeah, what's lunch? Like, what game are we playing in recess? Like, that's what we're thinking about. But they're like, oh, this is a serious thing. Keep it private and all this. I'm like, yo, what is this? Like, anyway, so I left school early that day, I remember. And my teacher, she followed me out of the classroom. And she was like, I just want to let you know, Bob Dole won. And I was like, oh, yay. You know, that she was like, yes, yes. She had like tears in her eyes and everything. And I'm like, what is this? Now I look back on it, I'm like, yo, what was I doing? Like, what was I in? And so anyway, I just had to say that about these little mock elections for these elementary school kids that don't even know what politics is yet.
Hey, but I'm a fan. Sooner the better. Get us involved in civics.
Well, see, yeah. I'll let you cook, and then I'll say what I
said. I'll say I was rather uninvolved as growing up in politics. I mean, I voted as soon as I could vote. I voted in certainly every presidential election and then every statewide election that I knew about, but I wasn't keeping tabs necessarily. And then, I mean, just fast forward all the way up, it was really the 2016 presidential election that got me hooked on politics and following politics at the national and state level and the local level too. All the way back in 2015, when you know, candidates were throwing their hat into the ring to be the representative for either the Democrat or Republican Party, and I was especially actually attuned to the Republican primaries because of evangelicalism. And I was sort of surrounded by white evangelicals. And I think what happened, and this is what happened to me, I think what happens to a lot of people is you just sort of absorb the political beliefs of the people around you and the people you trust. And so, you know, very seldom in these circles would I hear explicit messages about politics. But to the extent that I did hear about any particular issue, it was always a very politically conservative view. It was always a very white evangelical view. And as I started studying history, I was like, well, maybe we shouldn't just accept this. We got to filter this critically. And I'm looking at this slate of candidates, and so many of them are so problematic in so many ways, but especially on issues of race. And I'm just like, okay, where are Christians going to land in this? And so I started reading headlines constantly. And ever since then, I've been on it as much as I can be. And so the 2016 election really got me involved in politics, and I've tried to follow it ever since. But we'll get into this further in the show, sort of what the framework is or what the paradigm is for trying to parse through political issues and which candidates to support or whatnot.
Yeah, so I would say that for me, there's three main incidents that I can remember off the top of my head that kind of shaped me politically. But then beyond that, I think it was this natural default, what I would say, politics of suspicion. So it was like this politic that said there were foreign invaders, there were terrorists, there were immigrants. There's always other people who were out to get us. And it's like the weird thing of, you know, as some people have eloquently said, you have the cowboys and the Indians, you know, as they portrayed them, you know, and you were rooting for the cowboys when you didn't realize like, oh, we're the marginalized people. Mm. Like they want to kill us. And so it was this weird colonization of my mind that took place largely through Christian education. And so there was that third grade incident where we were voting for this mock election. And then beyond that, there was a moment in, I believe it was my sixth or seventh grade year, when Bush was running against Gore. And when Bush was running against Gore, it was interesting because there seemed to be a large consensus of how people thought within middle school, within our academy, which was overwhelmingly Christian. And then there was another like group of people, because there's only like four or five people per grade who are Black, who are, you know, Black or ethnic minorities. And so there was this one conversation that one young lady was having, and her father is also a pastor in town of a Black church, great man. And I actually didn't know him extremely well, but I knew he was a pastor and I'd heard him preach before, and I knew he was an honorable man. And they were having this conversation, I think it was at a lunch table, it was before a history class or something. And a couple of the white students were like, oh, well, so-and-so's a liar. They were talking about the candidate at the time, Gore. He was like, oh, Gore's a liar. And she just turned up. She's like, Bush is a liar. And I was like, whoa, like, and I just kind of looked at her. I was like, yo, how is she a Christian? Her dad's a pastor and they out here supporting Democrats. Like, how is that a thing? Like, you know, I mean, that was just my knee-jerk thought, because every class you go to doesn't show the other view charitably, or every class you go to, the people who you look up to, you don't recognize whether or not they're Republican or Democrat. They just couch it in great Americans or Americans who had flaws or what have you. And so even the people who we saw who were Black, who looked like us, they didn't really talk about their politics, only in the negative. So it wasn't really an explanation of their politics. It was just an assessment of their politics according to their own white evangelical narrative. So it wasn't interrogating their own politics in light of what this person, a lot of what Dr. King or Malcolm X or Rosa Parks or Richard Allen or Frederick Douglass or Absalom Jones believed. It was rather taking an assessment of what they believed and whether or not it was biblical, but without explaining why.
Yeah.
And so that was just my initial thought. I was like, huh, okay, that's interesting. And I went home and I talked to my parents about it. I was asking people, and it off put me because I didn't know. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand it. Well, fast forward, my third year of college was my first year at Liberty University. And that was that first semester was the election in 2008 between President Barack Obama and Senator John McCain. And so it was that first Obama election. And then I saw the rampant partisanship. Now, mind you, I never interrogated my own beliefs. I thought I was right. Like, there's a part of politics that intersects with hubris. And so if you believe something, you naturally think the other person is dead wrong, false, extremist, crazy, brainwashed. And that's how white evangelical political theory taught me to think about everyone who disagreed. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, well, if you protest, like, what's the point of being in the country? Well, that was the narrative. That's the narrative default thought. And so I remember hosting a forum the night before. And so I hosted a forum, and people could tell it was a mixed race forum, mixed ethnicity. And people could tell that I was leaning conservative, but it was actually a very interesting conversation where people challenged and they were talking back and forth, and I was kind of moderating that, and it was kind of a wide open forum. And I don't know why we did it, but it was kind of one of my initiations into my fraternity. They were like, look, you have to host this forum because if you're going to be, they were like, yo, if you're going to be a speaker for the frat, you have to host this forum and we got to see if you can actually do this. And I'm like, so you inviting random people to come and do this? They're like, that's right. They think it's going to be a debate between two people, but it's actually going to be a conversation that you moderate and you can do this. And I remember thinking, being so mad at them when they told me I had to do it. But now I'm so glad because that's kind of what I do. So I'm like, oh, okay, this is actually great training. But I remember seeing back and forth the people, and I saw that there was a distinct difference between Black Christian perspective and predominantly white Christian perspective. And it wasn't that it was necessarily 100% to either side, but I saw the difference. And then the next night, when President Obama wins, all the Black students, or most of the Black students, because I was not among them, were down in the bottom of the stadium celebrating, and the white students were up around the stadium, like in their seats, like scowling with their arms folded. And so there's this juxtaposition. And so it led me to ask this question, is there a difference between how white Christians process and how Black Christians process? So when you fast forward to Trayvon Martin, which kind of led me to think certain things, but I was still kind of clinging to conservatism, because again, there was hubris, there was pride, there was arrogance, there was ignorance. And I didn't really listen again to people who were properly, charitably expressing the viewpoints that I thought were extreme, the viewpoints that I thought were unbiblical or unchristian. And then Mike Brown was kind of, that's the point where I had kind of been leaning one way. There were a few more statements. And to be honest with you, meeting you guys was a big thing. Like meeting you and kind of processing these things from a Black Christian perspective, seeing the frustrations that you guys were having, even when I was tangentially involved, like I was like, man, this is kind of crazy. Like, why are these Christians not getting on board with this? I thought they would love this. And Mike Brown was kind of the big moment where I said, okay, I'm seeing drastically different expressions and interpretations of how this is affected, not just racially and socially, but I think what we do always connects to political theory, thought, policy, something. And so those are kind of touch point moments that led me to think through, like, man, am I actually believing the right thing? Am I believing something that's well thought out, that's nuanced? And so now I'm not saying I landed in a place, but I will say that I'm starting to interrogate my past, if that makes sense.
Oh, no doubt. Absolutely. And as you were talking, you were reminding me of other events. Like, if you study history from academic historians, it will disabuse you of a lot of mythology that you've grown up with, especially as regards evangelicalism. And so reading on the rise of the religious right was just like you pull back the curtains and you see Oz back there, the Wizard of Oz, just, you know, pulling levers and doing all these things to make himself look big.
Strings, you know, strings, man.
But it's an operation. And this stuff that we assume is just biblical was very culturally and politically driven. And there are a whole host of issues. I don't want to get into the weeds on it, but absolutely learning history.
No, we should, man, we should get into these weeds, man. That's what we're here for. Well, man, let's weed it out, man. Come on.
People can also buy the book and read chapter 8 or whatever.
I got you. I know you're not trying to give away everything.
That was one of the most, I don't know if exciting is the right word, but it was one of the chapters that as I was writing, it was like so enlightening as I was going through it. Because one of the big points of the chapter on the rise of the religious right is when the abortion issue comes to the fore. The religious right, as which means politically conservative, these are white evangelicals who have been mobilized politically for a particular party. It's a very partisan type of thing. And when that was happening, which was 70s, especially late 70s, moral majority comes into existence and all those kinds of things. When that was happening, though, abortion wasn't the main issue. The main issue was opposition to the IRS revoking tax exempt status for Christian schools,
right,
particularly schools like Bob Jones University, which lost its tax exempt status for its segregationist stance. So it's incredible that the political mobilization didn't only, but one of the main catalysts for bringing about the political mobilization of the religious right was maintenance of segregation in Christian schools. And so, you know, when you learn that history, you're like, okay, well, I got to go back further than the radio show or the news broadcast I'm hearing in 2018 right. and see where all this comes from.
And in many ways, it's painful to interrogate the origins of our ideology. But if we don't, we'll remain in balance and ignorant. And so it's important for us to take a step back and say, we have to do the hard work of self-interrogation. Where did I get this idea from? Like, I'm still hearing people, and this is, you know, side note, not necessarily political, but kind of is, but I'm still hearing people use reverse racism in 2018. Like, I'm still hearing people like actually saying like reverse racism is a thing. Like, it's a thing. They don't understand the gaps. They don't understand where it comes from. They don't understand that thought process. They just use it so casually. And it's making me think, man, a lot of people don't do the hard work, the painful work of self-interrogation. And so as we kind of move on and talk about, because I want to get to some principles here, before we get to principles, what would you say is the most difficult part of being a part of this political process right now? You know, what's the most difficult part for you? What's the thing that you struggle with the most? Because I hear an answer typically from Christians, but I'm very curious from a Black Christian man perspective. Like, what is that for you?
For me, the most difficult part of the political process right now is how radical to be. In the sense, it's politics, right? And so there's a pragmatic aspect to it, in the sense that any change might have to be incremental. Any change might have to come through compromise. But if you look back through the historical record, typically those incremental changes and those compromises don't lead to, at least not in a direct line, to the end goal that you're seeking, whatever that might be. And so there's a school of thought in activism and in politics where you just hold the line. You say, this is what we are asking for or demanding, and we're not going to back down on it. And typically, when I'm talking about folks who are drawing that hard line, it's in advocacy for the marginalized, right? It's for people to have enough money to live on. It's for people to have enough medical care. It's for people to be able to seek asylum in the United States, right? So it's not like these people I'm talking about are radically standing for something that would be detrimental to human flourishing. It's something that would lead to human flourishing. But then you have to wonder, is this going to be effective? Because there's another side that sees it differently, and they're not going to do what you want. Probably not ever, if you hold to everything that you're asking for. But if you negotiate, it's viewed as compromise, or sometimes it is compromise. So my difficulty is, you know, when to say, no, this absolutely has to be this way, and when to say, all right, we can compromise, even though I know the compromise is not going to lead to flourishing for this group of people.
Right, right. Yeah. So it's fascinating, because when you talk about radicalism and how radical you should or shouldn't be as a believer or as a participator in the political process, my mind goes back to this incredible, insightful book by Dr. Raphael Warnock, which is called The Divided Mind of the Black Church. And I don't know if you've had the chance to read it, but the central tension and premise that he says, the central theological tension of the Black church in America historically, is radicalism. And so he makes this pronouncement in the framing of the book that the Black church has been shaped both by racism, as we see in slavery, Civil War, Jim Crow, et cetera, and also anti-racism, which we see in freedom movements and civil rights movements. And so that it's produced this diverse response to oppression. So we have this like really mixed bag of responses, in some ways very conservative, in some ways radical. And so his whole idea in framing the book is, what is the mission of the church? Is it to save souls? Is it to correct the social order, or is it both? And so he brilliantly puts it as, you know, is it the slavery, is our main focus the slavery of sin or the sin of slavery, right? Nice. It's this tension between evangelicalism and liberationism. Mm. So he talks about this tension. And so I identify with it because the biggest struggle for me, in a similar way to you, is how do I parse out personal piety versus prophetic public witness? Like, how does all that intersect? And what do I think about when I go into the voting booth? Because the powerful thing about my background is I have a unique understanding of kind of conservative thinking, because I was steeped in it, I marinated in it. I'm still in some of those environments as far as where the city I live in, the people that I see. I'm always going to be interacting with them. They're my Facebook friends. If some of them listen to this podcast, I mean, so there's always going to be that interaction with that very strong conservative thought. But then on another sense, there's this idea now that once you see anti-racism, once you see the radical nature of, number one, the call of God in the scriptures for justice, and then also the people who took that call and directly contextualized it to the American context, to the American experience, to the Black church, to Black theology, to womanist theology, now you can't unsee it. So now I'm like, okay, well, I can't unsee this, but I'm shaped by both. And so a lot of what I have struggled with is, what do I hang on to and what do I put down? And what do I let go of? And what is a principle that I should hang on to that needs to be refined? And what's a principle that makes sense, but in reality, it's just imbalanced and it's slanted and it's presented in a narrative that doesn't do proper justice to a nuanced representation of what that actually means.
Woo.
So those are things that I'm thinking every time we enter into this political process. We're entering into an election cycle and we're thinking about administrations and we're seeing these things. I'm like, man, so what is the tension between what do I hang on to? What do I let go of? And when I say I'm growing in it, I'm careful to use the word growing, because I think I know I haven't grown enough, if that makes sense. I know I still have some more growing to do, more understanding to do. But I think I've kind of crafted at least some principles that I want to apply politically, that as I think through politics, I want to think through these particular things. And a lot of these things go against that politic of suspicion that I was raised in, I was steeped in, and against that conservative culture war mindset that would force me to think as of people as opponents that are coming to take what I have or what is rightfully mine, a colonizing mentality, so to speak. And so let's talk about some of these. What are some principles that we apply politically? Now, I've been kicking it back and forth to you, Jamar, but I'll kind of take the lead on this first one. And this first one is going to kind of sound like I'm the historian on the podcast, but I'm not. You're just rubbing off on me. Okay. You're just rubbing off on me. The first principle I would say is, I ask this question: which agenda on the ballot causes us to rehearse and replay our historic sins? Okay. So what I mean by that is this: America isn't America in a vacuum. We don't step into a political, you know, election or step into a ballot booth and we don't fill out a ballot in isolation or in a vacuum from where we've come from. And I think a lot of people act as though we don't have a history of replaying the same historic ills and sins again and again and again in our policies. Right. And so what is causing us to replay the same issues again and again? And I think it's because people just aren't looking at the political process as a continuation of a historic narrative. So every candidate is pushing forward a historic narrative. And most of the candidates that we will interact with are pushing forward a narrative that I would say depends on American exceptionalism, but beyond that, depends on American idealism, which is the idea that America can't do any wrong. Or if they have done wrong, we've corrected it in the past. And so now we just need to prevent doing wrong in the future, not we're doing wrong right now. Huh. Right. So I'm trying to think specifically, you know, I'd say three, maybe four things that I'm trying to see if this agenda is replaying is greed. Is this pushing us to greed and individualism? Racism. Is this pushing us to otherize ethnic minorities? Xenophobia. Is this pushing us to otherize people? And then a general callousness towards those who are marginalized and specifically the poor. So just those four things, greed, racism, xenophobia, and a callous political mind that is anti-compassionate. I'm just looking and seeing, is this agenda just replaying that same thing? Because if you're replaying any of those four things, it's going to be hard for me to cast a ballot for you. Now, this is different from issues. So I think people are saying, oh, well, it's this issue and I'm a this issue voter and it's about these two things. And this is much more about the narrative that we embrace rather than the issues where we land on those practically. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's huge when you say narrative, because politics is not separate from the rest of the story we tell ourselves. Politics is part of that. And unless we interrogate the story, the narrative of it, I don't think we'll actually understand our place in the political process or the presuppositions that we're coming with when we mm-hmm. enter the voting booth or what have you. So that I think, yeah, it makes good sense.
That's a big one also, because the Old Testament prophets are challenging the people of God to stop doing the cycle. Like, that's what they're constantly doing. Like, y'all always do this. It's the same cycle. Like, y'all doing the same exact thing every single time. Can you not do that? And so it's, if you see that narrative, if you see that pattern within the scriptures, now you're saying, okay, well we are also capable of replaying that narrative. As a matter of fact, we should assume we've done it without even thinking about it. We should assume not that we've got it all figured out, but we should actually assume, you know what? We probably just like the people in Israel in the Old Testament who were doing the same thing to the people who didn't have, who were doing the same thing to the people who were coming in and or who were in the same city. And they were like, well, you don't worship the same God or you don't do this, so I'm just not going to care about you, right? Yeah. Like, so anyway, I don't want to take all your time, but I just had to give you a historian. I'm going to give you a historian answer. But what about you? What is one principle that you would say you apply politically?
I mean, it might only be one principle, honestly, because it's just
plot twist.
It's very simple.
I'm coming with like eight principles and you're like, man, I only got one thing I'm thinking about, homie.
When I look at the issues and when I look at policy proposals and when I look at particular politicians, I'm asking what works for the most marginalized members of our community. And this comes from personal experience and study. So when I was a school teacher and a principal, but especially as a principal, my main job really was to set the culture of the school, cast the vision and help teachers, students, parents, and all constituents catch that vision and work toward it. And so that vision was only good to the degree that it served the students who, I won't say needed the most help, but needed the most support in a way. So these are the students on a very basic level who were most likely to get bullied, whether it's because of the way they looked or they talked or whatever. You know, this is middle school. So, you know, these are the students who didn't have many material resources. So that affected, you know, what field trips we went on or how we broke down the costs for students or how we offered support to families that were struggling financially. This went for, you know, even geographic location. We're in a rural environment. And so a lot of consideration went to when do we start school? Because when did the buses run and when did they get there for the students who are furthest out? and what time are they getting home and things of that nature. And you can broaden that out to living in the Delta, which for both Arkansas and Mississippi is the most materially impoverished part of the state. It's also the part of the state that has the highest concentration of Black people. And as I look at state politics, I'm like, well, if it doesn't work in the Delta, I don't want to see it. Because if it's not working for the most marginalized group, then you're just leaving them out. You're not incorporating them into your calculations, and it's too easy to overlook them because they don't have earthly power. They don't have political power. They don't have financial power. They don't have social networks and connections to get things done like other people. And so if you overlook that group that can do on an earthly standpoint not much for you, then I know where your heart is. I know where your values are. Conversely, if you are promoting policies and laws that can help, then what you're doing is you're tackling the toughest problems, the toughest issues. And if you're coming up with solutions that can stand up to those toughest issues, then you're good around the rest of the state. You're good with other groups who aren't facing as many obstacles. And so, you know, if I can beat the University of Alabama, I'm going to be good when I play the University of Mississippi or some other team. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, man, don't get into this, man. Don't get into this. Don't be mentioning the evil empire on this podcast.
Sorry, but you in South Alabama, though, right?
What? This boy cussing me out on live podcast.
But you get what I'm saying. It's anyway, like,
absolutely. I think that's actually very – that's enlightening. That's enlightening and challenging, and that's extremely helpful.
So like what I said, you know, it's complicated, like going back. Actually, truly radical would be, I define radical as those who would choose to work outside of the established system. So the truly radical people are the ones saying we need to trash capitalism and be a socialist country. The truly radical people are,
right.
You know, Black nationalists.
Yeah, like what's radical is weird. Yeah, like, what does that
exactly.
even mean?
It's a moving target to a certain extent, but you know, there on a spectrum, radical would be Black nationalists saying, "Hey, was Malcolm X saying? You know, the country owes us for 300 years of unpaid labor. We don't want to integrate with y'all. We want our own country. We want our own land, and y'all should pay for it, and y'all should divvy it out, and then we'll govern ourselves," right? Like, that's radical to an extent. Qualifying all of that, but you know, starting with how does this affect what Jesus would call the least of these, and going from there.
Yeah, that was kind of my number two as well, which is, you know, what pushes people groups away from flourishing? Like, that's a question I'm asking. Like, what pushes people groups away from it? Recognizing that much of American politics has been set up to keep certain groups from getting a seat at the table. Much of American politics has been set up to keep certain groups from having rights to exercise so that they would be able to enact, you know, policies and positions and bills that would actually be able to help them. So a big part of that is, are you believing in and espousing a political theology or political activism that is individualistic? And so if it is solely for you, if you start with, well, this is what happened when so-and-so was in office, I paid more in this way. And look, I'm not saying that doesn't matter. I'm just saying if that's the only thing you think about, if that's the only thing you consider, if that's the only idea, is like, how did this affect me? And how did this affect me from the standpoint of a representation of a broader group of people who have a right to be here? Then I'm kind of sitting back and I'm saying, we probably won't get along. We probably won't see eye to eye, because when it comes down to it, you're going to make decisions about who you feel should and shouldn't be here based upon which group you think you fit in. And that's the individualistic side of it that would make me say, I feel much more comfortable voting for someone who is not going to push people groups away from flourishing and away from the power that could eventually, you know, vote them out. You know, it's the whole idea of Amendment 4 in the past election for the state of Florida, which is granting incarcerated men and women the ability to vote. And what had previously happened was a previous governor had done a clemency process, but there were the fewest number of clemency grantings in his governorship than in any previous. And when you recognize that the governorship was decided by, you know, was decided by 1%, one percentage point each year that he was elected, then you sit back and say, well, him leaving 12,000, you know, incarcerated, formerly incarcerated people off the clemency list, him just dragging his feet to actually grant them the right to vote again actually has an outcome in elections. And so that to me is a major thing. And then since you don't have anything else, I'll just say one more. Since you didn't come with a list, you just came with one thing.
I got one more.
Oh, you got one more? Okay, well, yeah, give us your one more then. Give us your one more, and then I'm going to give my last one.
We've already touched on this, but it is canceling the culture wars. So anything that smacks of culture wars to me is automatically under a microscope.
And what you mean is, you mean white evangelical culture war, as white evangelicalism has defined it.
Yes,
correct.
That's the main context in which I hear the term culture wars is white evangelical political deployment. And then that's the issues, right? When you look at people and why they vote the way they vote, it's usually abortion, Supreme Court picks. Recently, it's been religious freedom, but by that, folks mean white evangelical religious freedom and more or less deprioritizing other religions to a certain degree. And it's this very small set of issues. It's small government for some reason that has been associated with being the more Christian way. And I think these are the kinds of issues that we're talking about earlier in the show when we're saying we sort of absorb these ideas or we were steeped in this culture. And that has been so detrimental because for me as a Black Christian, it was telling me not to pay attention to other issues that were highly pertinent to my communities. Issues like incarceration, issues like access to the ballot and voter suppression, issues such as funding for public education and the structure of public education. These kinds of things were off the table before when I was sort of steeped in a culture war political type of environment. And so now and it's also a more fundamental posture toward politics and American culture in general. It's a very us versus them. It's a very separatist kind of idea. It's here's our list. Right. And if you can't check every single box, you're against us. It's not just that you're different. It's not that we have to figure out how to get along in a pluralistic society with over 300 million people. It's that you're wrong. And I have to distance myself from you in order to protect my own sort of spiritual and theological integrity.
Right. You will pollute me. Exactly. You will infect me.
So anything that sort of smacks of that, of the world is icky and dirty, and we as the Christians who believe all the right things and take all the right stances on politics, I'm very, very sensitive to and cautious about at this point.
Right, right. That's good. That's very helpful. I would say my last one is, and this is as a Christian, it's something I've kind of been saying to myself, thinking through. It's that as a Christian, I don't believe when it comes to politics, especially as a pastor as well, I don't believe I should be partisan, but I also shouldn't be positionless. And I think there is this move in Christian political thought to be almost positionless political agents.
Say that.
And it's this idea, and I mean, because some people may misinterpret this, maybe like, man, you're talking about this person, that person. I'm not talking about anyone. I'm just saying, seriously, I just want us to think through this, because it is an idea of, well, both parties are wrong. And because both parties are wrong, we shouldn't be for any party. And I'm like, well, I don't know about that. At some point, you have to take a position. You know what I'm saying? Like, at some point, you can't be positionless. You can't be this like positionless cipher of consistency, because at some point, your positionlessness is going to cause you to be inconsistent. Like, you say you hold these values, and these values lead you to abstain from being partisan, but yet you won't take a position when you hear specific things. When they're separating kids from families at the border, that's not a time to be like, well, you know, I think both parties are kind of bad. No, that's them. That's not both parties. This is wrong. We need to stop this. Like, not, that's not the time to be like, well, you know. And I get that there's a sense now, which, you know, 2018 politics is bombastic. A lot of us, it's dramatic. A lot of us don't know political theory. We don't understand the compromise, and we don't understand any of this. But I will say that, you know, at some point in time, you have to take a stand and say, you know what? You violated this too much. I'm kind of done. Like, you should be out. Like, we should actually encourage people not to give you another turn. Like, because you continually violate human dignity. So this is kind of a problem for us. And I think Christians sometimes are like, whoa, should we do that? Should we say that? No, it's, if you have values and you care about the marginalized, beyond that, you care about the soul of any particular people group, and you care about their moral fidelity, any sort of moral stance, any sort of moral credibility. At some point, you have to look at it and say, you know what? I could point out and say, man, the church is voting for both parties. But the reality is that the majority of people are not voting for both parties. No, they're not. They're voting for one particular party in one particular people group. In the white evangelical people group, they're not voting for both parties equally. Speak to your party. Speak to the people. And that's why I just, that to me.
How you going to bring that up for the last one, man? There's so much in that.
Listen,
so
man, I'm just saying, that. I know, I'm Look. Just, and I'm not trying to be like, yo, so both of us, we recognize that you have to be prophetic to your tribe. And I get that. And I think there are issues even within Black church that we can talk about. And that's what a lot of the divide in mind of Black church talks about. And there's even stuff that he didn't even say in there that I probably would go into and expose, which we've discussed here before. But I'm just saying, man, at some point in time,
look,
our fear of being partisan is going to resign people to die, bro. Like, I just don't want to be bombastic, but people are dying. Like, so you're talking about, well, I don't want to be partisan. And they like, man, we want to take healthcare away from people. Well, you know, I don't want to be partisan. I know that the Democrats and this, and I'm like, bro, but they want to take healthcare away from people. So I can't, in that moment, take this position.
You can be political without being partisan. And that's a distinction we got to make, right?
I certainly hope so.
you can't be so fearful of being perceived as partisan that you fail to take a stance on justice and morality. And I think it's a very privileged position to take, to say, well, both sides have it wrong, because these are affecting down to earth, real life, bread and butter issues for human beings, image bearers, right? Like, that's our first priority, is love God, love others. And so if we see something that is unloving toward other people, it doesn't matter which party is doing it. You say, this is not the way God intended it in terms of human flourishing. And so I'm going to call it out. And it may happen to be more one party than the other at a particular time. That's not being partisan. That exactly. It's you remember in,
if it is, I don't care. No, like, if it is, I don't
care. In Joshua, right? Where the angel of the Lord appears and he says, are you for us or for our enemies? He says, no, I'm for God, right?
And what you mean? For yeah. whose side? Like, what you talking about?
If we're on the side of God, that's our answer. Are you Republican? Are you Democrat? I'm like, whatever. I'm for justice. I'm for Jesus.
Well, and that's, but that's the thing though, is you can't, that's what I'm talking about. And I think that's been my difficulty is we say, well, I'm not for either side. Okay. You just said something different though. You just said I'm for justice. And so if you're saying that's what you are for, okay, well then you're actually putting flesh on a skeleton.
You follow that.
You're not just saying I'm just this politically neutral. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's the privilege that I find in it is like you are insinuating that you have found a way to be perfectly balanced. Like you found a way to be perfectly, and I'm like, bro, you can't. And this is just something I'm dealing with, even local community, everything. People are like, man, you just don't take a side. And you, so I'm like, bro, this is harmful. And if this is harming people, I'm not going to sit back and be like, ah, man, well, you know, the compromise and this. No, I'm not in the office. My job isn't to actually get the bill through Congress. My job is not to write the bill. My job is to say, look, this right here is a violation. It's a violation of human dignity. According to the scriptures, according to what I believe about justice, it's a violation. We got to change this. And yes, does that mean that sometimes there's apparent inconsistency because our political process is inconsistent? Of course. We know that. And we accept that and we recognize that. But what I'm saying is, on the whole, you have to make an assessment about the parties.
Yeah.
You have to make an assessment. And that assessment is going to lead you. We're in a two-party system. That assessment is typically going to lead you to vote for a group of people that is flawed and that's messed up and got some bad policies in the mix. We know that. But on the whole, if a group of people is pushing forward an agenda that marginalizes groups of people, intentionally uses rhetoric, uses language, they know what's going on. They keep showing you the same thing. I can't sit up here and be like, well, I mean, I see it, but you know, both sides are really, I'm like, bro, at some point you got to take a side. Yeah. Like, look, yo, no, we for the people who are being harmed. I'm for the people who don't have health insurance. I'm for them. I'm taking a side. I need them to be okay. Like, I'm for them.
That a word, man.
I'm for the people that they separating at the border from their parents. I'm for those kids. Like, I'm for the refugees that, because this administration set 30,000 as the limit, one of the lowest limits in recent memory, I'm for them. And I can also still be for the unborn. I can still be for, like,
listen,
there's no, we can be for it. Like, yo,
the fundamental principle.
You better stop me, man. You better cut my mic off. This like,
is,
for
this
real.
Is a word. This is what we need to hear now. And I think the fundamental principle is justice takes sides. Justice is not neutral. Justice is not on the fence. Justice is, like you said, for the marginalized. Justice is for the oppressed. And at some points, that's going to mean you roll with Republicans. At some points, that's going to mean you roll with Democrats. We also have to be cognizant of the fact that if you look at policy platforms, especially in the 21st century, there's going to be a bulk of policies that seem to work for minorities. And there's going to be a party that has a bulk of policies that you can't really connect those dots. Now, some people say you can, and I think we can have conversations about that, but don't be afraid to listen. I also think at the end of the day, we need Christians who are Republicans and Christians who are Democrat. In a dual party system, we need believers who are salt and light within their own party to be prophetic to their own people.
But y'all got to be honest, though, man. Y'all got to be honest, bro.
That's a non-negotiable.
Just be honest, bro.
Like, we just...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We have done a terrible job on discipling people politically, because what it amounts to in so many cases is one of two things. Either you're hyper-partisan, and if we're talking about white evangelicals, that means you're Republican, straight ticket, or you're supposedly, which is not possible, but you're supposedly neutral. You don't take sides. I think both positions are bad. I think you side with justice,
yeah,
and that means you do take sides.
Yeah, and that's the thing I don't understand. Like people, and this is a question I've received so many times since 2014. I'll just address it, man. We just look, y'all know we just there. It. We there it? Right now. You we on one. Listen, no, you don't even know where I'm going. But he doing that to gas me up. He's like, yeah, it's like yeah, yeah. Nah, but since 2014, been on all these panels, and the question that always seems to come up at is weird at these panels. Were we talking about justice? Were we talking about police brutality? Were we talking about unjust violence against black bodies? Like, were we talking about this? People always talk about, well, why are black churches just voting Democrat? And I'm sitting back here and I'm like, you answered your own question. You asking that, you answered your own question. Because rather than putting the energy into challenging your elected officials to care enough about this to put their capital, their necks on the line, to make sure that our kids aren't shot in the street and we are not separated from our families, you just want to talk about the political machinations of us voting for Democrats. Well, hey, if you put forward a candidate who cares about our lives and cares about us making sure that we have a decent wage and cares about us having health care and cares about not redlining us and gentrifying, I mean, if you put forward that, okay, well, we'll talk. But that's the idea. Like, we are so focused on the appearance of what it looks like to be considered partisan that we are running ourselves. Again, I've said this before. We being so moderate that we become there mediocre. Yo, you got to have some sort of side here. Administer justice. The end. Do that and live. Like, this is Bible, guys. So I just... Look, I'm not saying there is no perfect candidate and there's no perfect party and there's no party I'm like, man, this party is perfect. What I am saying is it's very clear, and I'm just going to speak plainly. It's very clear that the Republican Party is not concerned with making the marginalized a part of their platform.
Right.
They are concerned with making one group, the unborn, a part of their platform.
When it's convenient.
But everyone else, and even that is conditional, which we can, you know, that's another podcast for another time. We'll get into that. We'll get into that later. They are very comfortable using black bodies as a political football to move that particular agenda down the field. But they are not comfortable with advocating for black bodies once they exit the womb. But that's another thing. Okay, not in education, not in economics, not in healthcare, not in any other way, but you're telling me you care about babies. Okay, fine, whatever. I don't believe you. But beyond that, what we don't see is we don't see Christians demanding from that Republican Party, you will have the marginalized on this platform. What do you do with the poor? Are you just assuming that they don't work? Are you assuming that they don't care? Man, what are you going to do with the people who don't have health care? Are you just throwing your hands up and saying, oh, well, too bad, so sad? Like, what are you going to do about the people who are coming and claiming asylum? Why are you picking and choosing? Why are you looking at bodies in the streets dead from state violence and just turning the other way?
Blaming it on the victim.
Or blaming it on them. Why is it always someone else's fault? What is wrong with the system?
Like, The political,
we just don't see it from that party. Let's just be honest. The political
calculus is very different. So you have some groups of people that are calculating how to keep and grow power. You have other groups of people that are calculating how do we survive? How do we live? How do we eat? How do we get to the doctor? How do we not get killed for being the wrong color? In the wrong place. All of these things are political in a certain dimension. And so when black Christians vote as a block, we're just like, who is not out to let me put it this way.
Who cares that we might die?
Yes.
Who cares that we might die, bro? Like, no gas. No, look, we see it. No cap, as they say, as my youth group said, no cap. No cap. Okay. Here.
See, I stay up to, on the latest lingo from you and your students.
Well, I'm late, okay, man. I'm late. but look, cap. Who are the people who are not going to see us dead in the street and just be like, oh, well, what's for dinner?
What the Republican leadership is banking on is not a numerical victory. They know that in terms of numbers, they are or soon will be a minority. What they're banking on is that they can grab enough power now to set the system up to where even if they don't have the numbers, they still win. They still win every time. And if you look at Congress, the number of women in the Republican Party as elected officials in Congress has gone down. It's at a record high with Democrats. And right now, Democrats are forming a coalition of minorities, which makes it difficult because every minority group has its own set of issues and policies they're trying to get passed.
But Absolutely. At the same time, yes.
There's at least lip service. Again, we qualify this all the time. No party's perfect. No party's not racist. But there's at least lip service to trying to, you know, respect victims of sexual violence, to hear the voices of immigrants, to attend to the concerns of Black people. You just don't see that. And you can look at any election in 2018, 2016. You can go as far back as you want. In the past 50 or 60 years or so, and there's been a pattern among each of the parties. And so the fundamental calculus is very, very different. And this is not a blanket statement. There are plenty of Black people who are conservative, plenty of Black people who are Republican.
Y'all know what we're saying, man. Come on. You can't look at this administration over the last 2 years and be like, man, we just been, it's just been.
I'm sorry, look.
It's just been a place where people just been affirmed and their dignity. When you start talking reckless about Black women, when you start challenging reporters, calling reporters dumb, calling their questions racist, enemy of the people. I mean, you just can't do that type of stuff. Like, and then we're just going to sit back and be like,
this is not
well,
partisan.
It's just justice. Right? And this, you know, and justice isn't sideless, bro. You have to pick a side.
Justice takes sides, like, period. And so, like, look. Much love to all y'all, wherever you are.
You know, this is wrong. You know we're in trouble. He's like, yo, much love to everybody.
You know.
Much love.
I just got to soften the blow for some people.
No, but I just, look, man, I can't.
Just, no. I'm saying, though, this is survival for people. And, like, if you don't get that, that's a fundamental issue you've got to wrestle with. You got to wrestle with
it. Absolutely.
Because it's not the case. It's not the case. And many people believe this, but it is not the case that millions upon millions of Black people, including Black Christians, have just been duped by the Democrats. It's not the case.
Yeah, like we actually have the power of intellectual thought and like critical thinking. Like we do have that ability. Like I promise you. Like we know who we're dealing with. And we know just because we vote someone into office, it does not mean that everything's going to be all right. Power is not, ultimate power is not granted to politicians. We know this. But we also can see that one side speaks to us and one side doesn't. And we can't lie about that. We can't just be like, oh, well, you know, I hope. No, we're not in a vacuum. We're in real life. And the world is broken, and that's just what it is. And we need to stop recording. We need to stop recording.
We need to stop this, yes.
Let's do this stop next time, okay? So we did part two. Let's do part three next time because I think it's important.
We got
to talk about books and resources that have shaped us in this way. So obviously there's the scriptures, and that goes without saying, but some people don't believe that it is what it is. Obviously, there's the scriptures, but then beyond that, there are books that have helped us to think through some of the modern current issues that we're dealing with in a way that we think is helpful, in a way that is encouraging, in a way that is more nuanced, balanced, whatever you want to, whatever helpful word you want to use. So let's do that next week. We'll give you our list. And you know, we got our top five cultural artifacts of the year that's coming up following week. We may do two next week because we know we've missed. So who knows what'll happen, but tune in next time and you'll find out on Pass the Mic. Don't at us. Do not at us, y'all. Don't send this to so-and-so. Don't you at know. Us. Don't at us. We said like, what we
when
said.
You know they're just going to disagree. Like, send it
we
to
said what we
you
said.
Know, your friend or whatever. Like, hey,
no,
here's
we said what we said what we said. That's
but
what
there's
I'm
some
saying.
Folks out there who are like, ooh, look what they said this time. What are you going to say? What are you going to
do?
Like,
man, this ain't we not going to engage in it. We told y'all previously we dead to that. It's not we not even looking at it. But I'm just saying, hilarious. Don't at that's us. Hilarious. We said what we said. We out. We'll be back next week.
Politics. Peace.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Truce Podcast. The new season examines the connection between some evangelicals and the Republican Party with the help of world-class historians. Subscribe to Truce in your podcast app or listen at trucepodcast.com.